In many countries, the capital is also the principal city. London and Paris were for centuries the hubs of finance, trade and culture, as well as government. A few capitals have been built from scratch, such as Canberra and Brasilia in the 20th century. But the world's first purpose-built national capital was Washington, D.C. D.C. stands for the District of Columbia, a diamond of land originally 10 miles square that was carved out of Virginia and Maryland in 1791. The final decisions about location and design were made by George Washington, America's first president, and the city bears his name. But behind these decisions was a complex bargain between the North and the South that held the Union together and also helped make America a great economic power. By 1790, the question of a new capital had become a sick joke. Haggling about where to site it had deadlocked American politics for years, while the federal government moved from town to town like a travelling circus. No less than 16 sites had been proposed, from New York to Virginia, and nobody seemed willing to give way. Part of the problem was local pride, but the winner would also gain economically through new industries and services, the benefits of the capital being estimated at a cool $500,000 a year. A newspaper editor from the northern state of Maine deplored all the wrangling.
"We should remember, the question is not what will be most convenient or best suit the interest of New England, but what does the interest of the Union require? But that last, I suppose, would be an odd question in Congress. There it is the southern interest or the northern, and every man of them ranges himself upon one side or the other, and contends with as much earnestness and warmth as if at an Olympic game."
The Virginians were particularly fierce competitors. Convinced that the Potomac River led deep into the American interior, they believed it could be a gateway to the riches of the West. Thomas Jefferson, though professing to despise commerce in principle, was determined to cash in on what we might call these capital gains. Jefferson wrote,
"All the world is becoming commercial. Was it practicable to keep our new empire separated from them, we might indulge ourselves in speculating whether commerce contributes to the happiness of mankind. But we cannot separate ourselves from them. Our citizens have had too full a taste of the comforts furnished by the arts and manufactures to be debarred the use of them. We must then, in our own defense, endeavor to share as large a portion as we can of this modern source of wealth and power. Nature has declared in favor of the Potomac, and through that channel offers to pour into our lap the whole commerce of the Western world."
The Virginians got their chance in 1790. There was a massive row over the proposals by Alexander Hamilton of New York, the new Treasury Secretary, for dealing with America's huge debts from the War of Independence. Hamilton estimated the country's total obligations at $77 million, perhaps $5 trillion today, and he believed they had to be put on a sound footing.
"To be able to borrow upon good terms, it is essential that the credit of a nation should be well established. States, like individuals who observe their engagements, are respected and trusted, while the reverse is the fate of those who pursue an opposite conduct. This reflection derives additional strength from the nature of the debt of the United States. It was the price of liberty. The faith of America has been repeatedly pledged for it."
Hamilton proposed that the federal government take over $40 million of debts owed to individual American lenders. This, he said, should be at the face value on the notes and securities. But James Madison of Virginia, the principal architect of the new Constitution, objected that many patriots who'd originally loaned money to the cause, including soldiers who'd been given the notes as IOUs instead of pay, had since sold them off at a fraction of their original value. So redeeming the notes at face value would benefit speculators who'd bought them up, mostly men from the North. But Hamilton, like a good capitalist, argued that each speculator had
paid what the commodity was worth in the market and took the risks of reimbursement upon himself. He ought to reap the benefit of his hazard. A discrimination between the different classes of creditors of the United States cannot, with propriety, be made.
Hamilton's proposals provoked an outcry. Benjamin Rush of Virginia told Madison,
"Never have I heard more rage expressed against the oppressors of our country during the late war than I daily hear against the men who are to reap all the benefits of the Revolution, at the expense of the greatest part of the virtue and property that purchased it. Many of them are not worthy of the privileges of citizenship in the United States."
But in February 1790, the House of Representatives voted to approve Hamilton's proposals for taking over the debt owed to individual Americans. So a furious Madison was all the more determined to block Hamilton's other big idea, that the federal government assumed the debts that the states themselves had run up in order to pay for their share of the war. Amounting to about $25 million, these were owed mainly to northern states, because Virginia and most of the South had already paid off the bulk of their war debts. So Madison argued that Hamilton's proposal was unjust to Southerners.
"Compelling them, after having done their duty, to contribute to those states who have not equally done their duty."
Madison managed the opposition with great skill, and by June 1790, Hamilton was in despair about this keystone of his plan to rebuild the nation's finances. He decided to speak with Jefferson, who was a fellow member of Washington's government, then encamped in New York. According to Jefferson,
"Going to the president's house one day, I met Hamilton as I approached the door. His look was somber, haggard, and dejected beyond description. Even his dress was uncouth and neglected. He asked to speak with me. We stood in the street near the door. He opened the subject of the assumption of the state debts, the necessity of it. He said if he had not credit enough to carry such a measure as that, he was determined to resign. He added his wish that I would interest my friends from the South, who were those most opposed to it."
Jefferson decided to invite Hamilton and Madison to dinner at his house, 57 Maiden Lane, a few blocks from Wall Street. According to Jefferson's account of the evening,
"They came. I opened the subject to them, acknowledged that my situation had not permitted me to understand it sufficiently, but encouraged them to consider the thing together. They did so. It ended with Mr. Madison's acquiescence in proposition that the question of assuming the state debts should be again brought before the House of Representatives, that, though he would not vote for it, nor entirely withdraw his opposition, yet he should not be strenuous, but leave it to its fate. It was observed, I forget by which of them, that as the pill would be a bitter one to the southern states, something should be done to soothe them, that the removal of the seat of government to the Potomac was a just measure, and would probably be a popular one with them, and would be a proper one to follow the assumption."
There was, of course, a lot more to the deal than that. The dinner at Jefferson's was part of an intricate set of meetings. But essentially, Hamilton got his financial plan through Congress, while Madison and Jefferson ensured that the new federal capital would be located on the Potomac River in Virginia. In due course, as Jefferson grasped the full scope of Hamilton's financial system, he felt he'd been duped. But at the time, this deal showed that Jefferson and Hamilton, despite their ideological differences about agriculture versus commerce, were also practical politicians. What's more, this compromise in 1790 held the infant United States together when it seemed to be breaking apart. It was, in fact, the first of three great compromises 30 years apart, in 1790, 1820, and 1850, that kept North and South within the Union despite the growing tensions between them. But the great capital of which Madison and Washington dreamed was not completed in their lifetimes. The new president devoted a vast amount of time and energy to its realisation, and the plans were truly spectacular. What architect Pierre L'Enfant called the President's Palace was sited on one hill and the Congress House on another, linked together by a spacious avenue 160 feet wide. But the designs were deemed too grandiose, funds were cut, and little was built. Worse still, it seemed that nobody wanted to live in the city. Land auctions had few takers, and merchants didn't want to relocate. Philadelphia and New York remained America's great ports. When President John Adams, George Washington's successor, was finally able to move down to the city in 1800, the presidential mansion, reeking of wet paint and new plaster, stood in a weed-ridden field full of stones and rubble. His wife Abigail grumbled about her new home.
"The lighting the apartments, from the kitchen to parlors and chambers, is a tax indeed. And the fires we are obliged to keep to secure us from daily agues is another very cheering comfort. To assist us in this great castle and render less attendance necessary, bells are wholly wanting, not one single one being hung through the whole house, and promises are all you can obtain. The house is made habitable, but there is not a single apartment finished. We have not the least fence, yard, or other convenience without, and the great unfinished audience room I make a drying room of to hang up the clothes in."
So Mrs. Adams pegged out her laundry in the unplastered East Room, venue today for the grandest of state occasions. For decades, the great capital on the Potomac remained a mess, with boardwalks through the mud linking isolated, often unfinished classical buildings. The effect was rather like wandering through Roman ruins. Diplomats paying their respects at the president's house in full regalia would often alight from their carriages and sink ankle-deep into the mud. European visitors, used to the elegance of London or Paris, scoffed at America's invented capital, which seemed to sum up the bombastic pretensions of this upstart republic. Yet the desolation that was Washington testified to a deeper truth about US politics. The president disappeared for at least 3 months of the year. Congress was usually in session only from November to March, between harvest and spring planting. And the Supreme Court needed just a couple of months to complete its annual business. The federal government had only 9,000 employees in 1802, and that included the armed forces. For most Americans, the only evidence of the new federal government in their daily lives was the local US post office. Such government business as seemed necessary was transacted by the states and especially the towns or counties. That's what the founders meant by federalism. Not centralization, but its very opposite, the devolution of power. So Washington, D.C. looked marginal because it was marginal to the lives of the American people. And it remained so for much of the 19th century.